This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In a world where unreality is taking over, there is still a floodlight to find the facts. It's called science, but that's not easy to understand, and there's more and more of it. We need translators. We need scouts to call out from ahead. Robert Marston Fanny is one of those voices. In my opinion, he has two great skills that help him. Robert was a threat analyst for the world's premier information group called JANES. He knows how to dig and research. But above that, Robert Marston Fanny is also an author of a popular science fiction series called Luthiel's Song. And taking those skills to analyze danger and his creative writing, Robert Marston Fanny has produced one of the world's top hubs for disseminating climate science. It's called Robert Scribbler's Blog, and it's kind of a community now, really. Robert Marston Fanny, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It really is an honor to be here, and thank you for that very kind introduction. It's great to be back.
Well, it's been a while. Unbelievably, it's pretty well 3 years later, and people are still downloading our last conversation at a rate of about 200 shows a month. And that seems like ages ago. So much has happened, and climate news continues to pour in at a mad rate. It is hard to keep up, isn't it?
It is overwhelming. When I started in 2012, the pace was somewhat manageable in the sense that I could look at a set of topics that I thought were important in that given time and be able to mostly highlight them all. And now I think anyone that is covering climate science is trying to play catch up. It's feeling like they're running to standstill just because there is so much information right now. There's so much that is happening that appears to be critical and probably is. And in all honesty, I think if the New York Times had devoted all of its staff to trying to cover climate change, they would still not be able to hit everything that needs to be hit. It really has gotten to that point.
Well, we need to get to Carlos Slim or Jeff Bezos and say, that's what we need. We need a huge national staff and all the resources just to get this catastrophe on the front pages and the back pages.
Well, threat awareness is very important. It's funny, a fellow blogger of mine, Nevin, who covers sea ice primarily, recently went on sabbatical, and it's an overwhelming issue. But one of the things that he mentioned to me was that not only is it psychologically difficult, it's just such a huge problem, and it's so important to everyone. But one of the things I said to him, he was depressed. He was saying that, well, all I'm doing is focusing on problems. And I said, well, the first part of dealing with a problem is coming to grips with it, is trying to understand it. And if you don't understand it, then you really can't develop an effective response. And I think that many of us are really still trying to get a good picture of the threat. There are many different opinions, I think, about the threat of climate change. There are many very informed opinions, but I still think as a civilization, this is an out-of-context problem. This is not something that we're used to dealing with. And so identifying that threat is part of the process of response. It's the first step.
Well, okay, let's get specific here, Robert. And this is something that Nevin actually came back from his sabbatical just to write a piece about. And it's one of the biggest stories in the world, I think, but it's not that big on Twitter or Instagram. And it's just this, the total amount of sea ice on the planet is falling. And that seems pretty darn important. But in a recent interview on Radio EcoShock, our Canadian climate scientist guest, Paul Beckwith, complained that the scientists in his community just didn't seem interested in that fact. And I suppose for a while it seemed like the ice loss in the Arctic was being countered by growing sea ice in the Antarctic. But this year, they both crashed. And the fact is, we're melting the ice right off the planet. So Robert Scribbler's blog captured the big picture, I think, on January 13th with this blog title, "The World Has Never Experienced a Time When Global Sea Ice Was So Weak and Reduced." Robert, are there enough exclamation marks to capture this huge moment?
I don't think so. In all honesty, at a certain point, superlatives become dull because when it comes to climate science, everything appears to be superlative to me at this time. And global sea ice coverage in 2016 was one of the huge exclamation marks. We had the hottest year on record. It looks like, according to GISS, it looks like we are going to hit about 1.2 degrees Celsius above average in the atmosphere for 2016. And both the Arctic and Antarctic experienced above normal temperatures, significant above normal temperatures. The Arctic in particular, during the fall and spring and winter of 2016, the summer was relatively average, but the other three seasons were ridiculously warm. And in the fall especially, we had days when the entire Arctic region, and that's the entire region above the 66 degree north latitude line, so you're talking about an enormous area, that it was hitting about 11 degrees Celsius above average in that entire region on certain days. And there was a month, it was October, in which the averages for the entire region for the month were in the range of 5 to 6 degrees Celsius above average. And I know these are just numbers, but it's ludicrous. You never see areas of the world of such an extent, such an expanse, such a large expanse of the world hit temperatures that are that far above average for such a long period of time. You just don't ever see it, but we saw it in 2016, and it's quite frankly, to me, it's pretty terrifying. If there are scientists, as you said, that Paul Beckwith said that there were scientists that weren't concerned about sea ice, in all honesty, I can't imagine why they would not be concerned about sea ice if that was the case. Sea ice is a critical aspect of the climate system. It serves as a deflector shield for incoming solar radiation. It cools the Earth. It covers an enormous area. It houses numerous ecosystems and is basically the home for some of the most vital life support systems on the planet. The polar regions of the world are the most productive, meaning that they are, especially in the oceans, they are in many ways the source of the vitality of life on Earth. And so if you start to lose sea ice, you lose a critical feature of the climate system and you lose a critical defense against short-term, medium-term, and long-term warming. And so if you understand climate, and you understand how the climate system works, and you understand ecosystems, and you understand how life on Earth works, then sea ice is very important. It's something that we need to maintain a stable climate. And if we lose that, then we really don't have a stable climate anymore.
Well, I followed a link from your blog to the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center. I think they're in Colorado, and they put out a report on January the 1st about the low sea ice extent continuing at both poles. Do we know from them how much sea ice we've lost? I mean, I looked at their graphs, and you can see all the past years as certain colored lines slowly getting lower, and then this year it's like a garish red line that just, boom, drops off the bottom of the graph.
So I want to be pretty clear about NSIDC. I think that NSIDC, based on that report, it seemed to me that they were very concerned. Maybe I'm wrong. I haven't spoken to any of the scientists there, but this is the most alarming report I've ever seen from them. And scientists generally tend to moderate and try and speak in a moderate way. Scientists tend to try to not alarm people. So when you're dealing with alarming data and you're a scientist, you're kind of walking a razor thin line. But with regards to the amount of sea ice that has been lost globally in the latter portion of 2016, during December, global sea ice extent, according to NSIDC, hit a negative 4.4 million square kilometers. And that's like losing two Greenlands worth of sea ice. And global sea ice extent, according to the NSIDC measure, has never dropped so low, ever. That's a 8 sigma standard deviation outside the norm for the average range from 1980 to 2010. Eight sigma, when you talk about standard deviations, if you go beyond two standard deviations, you're talking about a rare event. An eight sigma event is something like one in many billions probability of occurring under normal variant circumstances. Of course, as we know, the world is warming, so for the Arctic, there's something, and the Antarctic, that there's something that is removing sea ice, and we know that that is global temperature. And so it's ocean temperature anomalies in a very high positive range, and it's global atmospheric temperature anomalies. And in the polar region, there's a process called polar amplification, which tends to preferentially warm the poles, particularly the Arctic. But it appears that in 2016, the Antarctic experienced a decent amount of polar amplification as well. So with regards, though, to how much ice has been lost over an extended period of time, it's extraordinary. We've never experienced that much global sea ice loss in the monitor in any season, in any period. During 2012, we saw very severe sea ice losses in the Arctic, but this is a global event, and both poles were involved.
Robert, I'm going to cut in here and play 2 minutes from Dr. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers. This was just posted on YouTube January 16th by John Cook. It's about a new Arctic feedback.
2016 has been a bizarre year right from the get-go. We're seeing a new feedback develop between the Arctic being so warm and its effect on the jet stream and vice versa. The very warm Arctic in the early fall is causing the jet stream to take a wavier path. This is something we've been studying for a while. And those bigger swings in the jet stream are transporting more heat and moisture up into the Arctic. The heat is obvious, that melts more ice, but that moisture is a big part of the story. And we're seeing in 2016 an all-time record high amount of water vapor in the atmosphere in the Arctic. Now that water vapor is important because it's a greenhouse gas, so it contributes to the already warming effects of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but it's also it causes more clouds to form, and those clouds are also very good at trapping the heat down by the surface. So we've got all this extra water vapor in the atmosphere that has been transported from the south by this wavy jet stream, but also because there's more evaporation in the open water areas where there used to be sea ice. So there's kind of a double whammy there in terms of that really important water vapor. So then the feedback part of the story is that because the Arctic has been staying so warm this fall, I mean, crazy warm, 20 degrees centigrade on some days warmer than average, that is feeding back then to the jet stream and causing it to continue to be very wavy, which continues to pump more heat and moisture up there. So we're seeing this new feedback mechanism kicking in that I think is playing a big role in this fall being so ridiculously warm.
That was Dr. Jennifer Francis on the new Arctic feedback. Let's move on now with our guest, Robert Marston Fanny from Robert Scribler's blog. We know the White House is filling up with worst kinds of climate deniers. The people who promise to reduce or destroy every branch of government have been given power over them. We won't talk about the billionaire Secretary of Education who hates the public school system, or the billionaire labor secretary who hates organized labor. But we do have to talk about the people who swore to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency and the Paris Climate Accord, and now the fossil fuel kings promise to make America into a great oil exporter again, damn the climate, full speed into the apocalypse. Robert Marston Fanny, what do you think the new captains of the American government could or will do?
Well, if they operate in the manner that they promise, they will set us back at least a decade when it comes to climate responses. Unless, if states and Congress and, say, for example, progressives or people who are concerned about climate change in Congress, there could be some Republicans. I don't see many, but I guess one could hope. if there was a stiff resistance, we could nearly just stand still on climate policy in the U.S. for 4 years and basically just resist Trump. And honestly, that would be the best case scenario, is to simply stand still. It's possible that states on their own and cities on their own could produce positive climate policies. But if you're fighting the federal government, there will be certainly a give and take. So I think that the net would be about zero when it comes to policy, even if everything on every other scale was amazingly positive. If you have a president that is against climate action, that fights it, that goes after scientists, that goes after the Paris Climate Summit, that harasses other world leaders who are interested in confronting climate change, who shames people for talking about climate change, who puts a person like Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who has been involved in spreading climate change denial through ExxonMobil's media support and public relations activities for, you know, as long as he's been an executive there. So what we're dealing with is, as president, as the cabinet, people who have been fighting to delay climate action for most of their adult lives, and who in their public communications have misinformed the public about climate change, have downplayed the issue of climate change, and have, by that communication, sought to continuously sandbag any efforts to promote solutions to climate change and to make people aware. So that's a worst-case scenario for the U.S. and for the world, because America matters. America's global leadership matters. When Obama was president, don't get me wrong, Obama wasn't perfect as a climate leader, but Obama did produce a good deal of progress when it came to climate change, numerous policies that were beneficial in a net sense, and renewable energy efficiency, reducing consumption, harmful consumption, all occurred while Obama was president. And he promoted people who were leaders in the climate movement into his cabinet. What you have here with Trump is the opposite. You have people who have attacked scientists. You have people who actively lie about climate change to the public. And Trump is one of those. I mean, that's the exact opposite of leadership. It's anti-leadership.
I want to get to another point, and that is that most of humanity does live in the Northern Hemisphere. That's where most of the land is. And, of course, it bothers my Australian and New Zealand listeners and people in South Africa to no end that we talk about us so loudly on the social media. And right now, for us, it's winter. And it's easy for us to forget about the heat that will drive millions of other people from their homes. And of course, that's when I admired that while we're fixated on winter, you and your blog warned about new uninhabitable zones from heat, not just in North Africa, but in the very countries who earn their huge riches by exporting fossil fuels like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. And it's going to ruin their home climate. Tell us about that blog posted in December about the great heat.
So the Max Planck Institute this year and last year has been producing excellent research about habitability in certain regions of the world just simply based on increase in temperature. Recently, there's been a number of media reports based on that research. I happened to pitch in because I thought it was an important issue. Now, what we're dealing with as the world warms is a region of the world near the equator that will ultimately become uninhabitable. Now, when we talk about uninhabitable, we talk about uninhabitable if you venture outside. It doesn't mean that there wouldn't be areas where climate was completely controlled indoors where people could survive. It's just that outdoor activity would be severely limited, as if you were living in a large region of the world that had temperatures similar to Death Valley type conditions. And what you're talking about is not just a small area. You're talking about a band, a large band of Africa that includes the near Sahara region, much of the Sahel region, such as Sudan. You're talking about Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, parts of Turkey. You're talking about Israel in some, well, southern Israel, the Sinai Peninsula. And that's really kind of ground zero for where the uninhabitability ban starts. It kind of starts in that region and then it expands. And what Max Planck is talking about, currently we have about that region experiences about 11 to 20 days every year presently where temperatures are above 40 degrees Celsius every year, right? And we think of this region of the world as very hot. So on average, about 11 to 20 days, it's above 40 degrees Celsius. That's 104 degrees Fahrenheit for people who are Fahrenheit oriented. By mid-century, that period of time is expected to, according to Max Planck, extend to 80 days. So you're basically taking this extremely warm region of the world and you're multiplying the number of very hot days by about 4 to 8. And some of the maximum temperatures in that region are expected to reach, you know, well above 46 or 50 degrees Celsius on many days. 50 degrees Celsius is 122 degrees Fahrenheit. And the average for that region is expected to increase by 2.5 to 6 degrees Celsius by mid-century. And this is under middle-term fossil fuel emissions. It's not pure business as usual, which would advance that time frame a bit. So what you're talking about is a region of the world where it just becomes less and less possible to operate outdoors. And it's not just an issue of crops. Crops in those kinds of situations simply become non-viable for many places. You can't grow things right now in Saudi Arabia outdoors unless you're constantly watering things. So imagine a Saudi Arabia-type environment extending over a good chunk of northern Africa and expanding southward as the Sahel region starts to lose its vegetation unless there's some extraordinary kind of effort on the part of governments there to try and maintain habitats or put extremely resilient plant life down, which I don't know if even that's possible when you start to talk about those temperatures. You're talking about basic uninhabitability for that period of time. And that's a real concern. In the most extreme cases, you're also talking about exceeding human limits for survivability outdoors. You're talking about pushing wet bulbs above 35 C in many locations. And that's one of the things that happens when you start to warm the globe by more than 2 degrees Celsius.
And there are things we have to do outside. I mean, outside of agriculture, if you want to build something or fix something, you have to go out, and it's human nature to have to go out. So I think there comes a point, and I don't know when that point is yet, but thousands of people and then hundreds of thousands and then millions have to leave. And now it looks like Britain, the United States, and most European countries are closing up. Robert Marston Fanny, what happens when millions of people can't stay and can't find anywhere to go?
To that point, that region of the world does house, currently about 400 million people inhabit that region of the world. And when you start to make those regions uninhabitable, I mean, some people could probably still stay, but what you are doing is reducing the carrying capacity of those regions unless there's an extremely huge amount of energy just spent building indoor habitats. So what you're talking about is tens of millions, likely hundreds of millions of people migrating. And what we saw after the Arab Spring and the food crises that happened in the Middle East and then the subsequent instability in places like Syria is minor by comparison. Unless there is some kind of amazing global effort to build terraformed indoor habitats for people that live in these regions, many of these people will move. And so that creates a destabilization pressure for governments and for people that can't handle migration or won't handle migration or who are individually biased against people who need help or people who are different. from who they are. And some countries do manage to deal with migrants well, but these societies tend to be both resource-rich and rich in kindness. And many, unfortunately, many societies tend to become more closed as multiple waves of migrants start to move through. And that is a destabilizing aspect. It tends to make politics more extreme. It tends to become, these poor victimized people tend to become scapegoats for people who are pandering to hatred. And that's just not a good picture. If we're going to confront climate change and if we're going to try and adapt to climate change, part of adaptation is learning to be kind to one another, to learn to share resources, not to hoard resources. And dealing with migration is something that we are going to have to do, even in the better case scenarios. So that's one of the threats that we really need to be aware of and we need to be honest about. We need to confront ourselves, to look into the heart of darkness and say, we refuse to be jerks. We refuse to turn these people away.
Well, we'll see. I'm not very optimistic about that myself. I see a source of great troubles coming from that. And we haven't even talked about rising seas. Like in Bangladesh, millions of people are going to have to move, and there's nowhere for them to go. I mean, India's already totally crowded on their borders and so on. So we're going to have to leave that one for another day. Well, now, Robert, I have to yell a bit. Not at you, but at all of us. We have this fixation for records. There's been plenty broken in the last few years, but now, if something really dangerous is just continuing, but it's not an all-time record, we feel relieved. Maybe it's okay. We're a little bored. We've lost the appropriate emotion, which is rising fear. And 2016 was not a record year for increasing greenhouse gas emissions, we're told. But does that mean we're okay?
No, we're certainly not okay. So the reports are not conclusive, that there is some optimism baked in, but this needs to come with a few caveats. So what's happening is global coal use, it appears, and there's some pretty clear evidence that in many places around the world, coal plants are being shut down. And this is happening in the U.S., this is happening in Europe, this is happening apparently in China. China's had a number of policies that have targeted their least efficient coal plants, their dirtiest coal plants. And so what has happened as a result of this is it appears that since 2013, global carbon emissions have plateaued. It's possible that they may have grown a little slight amounts, I mean, but compared to the past growth rates, it's about stable. It may have dropped off. No one at this point can really put a clear pin in exactly where it is because we're not too sure about the accuracy of data coming out of China. That said, it does appear that has happened. We're basically on a plateau at record high global carbon emissions levels. So at record high global carbon emissions levels is not a good place to be. Where you want to be is global carbon emissions are falling. And when I say record high global carbon emissions, we are at in excess of 33 billion tons of CO2 hitting the atmosphere every year. We're talking about 50 billion tons of CO2 equivalent gases hitting the atmosphere every year. And that's insane. That's 10 times faster than the rate of carbon hitting the atmosphere during the last mass extinction, during the PETM in the past 65 million years. If you take all the global carbon emissions coming from the Earth system, from the environment in the past 65 million years, we are emitting at about 10 times, maybe as much as 20 times faster than the last time the world heated up really fast. So what the human world is doing is just nuts. And where we are right now is a bad place. It's better to be at a plateau in human emissions, but we should put this in perspective. We are still very, very, very far behind the eight ball when it comes to actually doing something that's going to prevent harmful climate change. And in order to do that, emissions need to fall to zero in a rather short period of time.
Well, they're at least stop increasing every year, and they are increasing every year. And people don't understand that when you increase and increase, you get pretty big numbers within a decade or two decades, and that's still the track we're on.
What I will say is that we do have an opportunity right now. If you continue to shut down coal and you start moving on to other fossil fuel energy sources, you do have an opportunity to start to bend down that emissions curve. We have the technical means of doing that now, in the sense of actually replacing carbon-emitting energy with zero carbon-emitting energy or low carbon-emitting energy. And we also have the capability to start to replace the transportation and, to some extent, the manufacturing chains that are carbon-emitting. So if we're aggressive, we can actually start to bend that curve down now, but it would take India not building new coal plants. It would take China continuing to shut down coal plants and shutting them down at a pretty rapid pace and shutting down coal plants on a global scale. And then from that point, moving to decarbonizing transport, starting to decarbonize ground transport. And in addition to that, it would be really helpful if we could get some efficiency policies out there that actually disincentivize the worst type of consumptive activities that produce carbon emissions. So we are kind of in a spot now where the growth of carbon emissions from the human source has taken a pause. And so the question is, are we as a society going to listen to all these, you know, all the people saying, well, no, we shouldn't be shutting down coal plants, or, you know, listening to the Trumps of the world, listening to the Abbotts of the world? You know, no, we shouldn't be attacking these industries. Or are we going to actually make progress? Or are we going to make the choice to shift away from harmful practices that are more harmful than the cigarette industry ever was, that through pollution alone result in 7 million deaths every year? Are we going to start to move away from that, take this opportunity to concertedly move away from that? We can do that now if we have the global political will.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking with novelist, professional threat analyst, and top climate blogger Robert Marston Fanny. I often feed from his passionate but science-based posts on Robert Scribler's blog. All right, well, let's talk about your blog. Another positive thing that you find that I have failed to find is saying solar now produces a better energy return on investment than oil. Tell us about that.
So the Royal Society put out a study earlier this year that indicated that solar energy as just a net energy producer was superior to oil. And now, don't get me wrong, net energy from oil is falling, and there's a lot of reasons for that. The first is that we are starting to rely more and more on unconventional sources of oil, sources like tar sands that require huge natural gas power plants just to heat up the bitumen, and sources like fracking that require a lot of mechanical energy, a lot of physical effort just to crack up the ground and force all those fluids down into the earth just to get the oil out. So the easy oil in many places is gone. There's no more self-pressurized fields where you just poke a hole in it and the oil just shoots out. So what's happened is that because you have to expend more energy to get the oil out of the ground, the energy return on energy invested for oil is falling. There is a technological process and a manufacturing process related to solar energy that both increases the efficiency of solar cells and increases the efficiency of producing solar cells that actually reduces the net energy necessary to manufacture solar. And according to the Royal Society, the energy return on energy investment for solar is now around 15 to 1, and that oil is now about fallen below that figure. And so it appears that for net energy, there has been an inflection point, at least in this one study. Now, this is a scientific study, and it is the Royal Society, so I definitely listen to what they have to say. And in addition to that, the National Renewable Energy Labs in the U.S. have been producing similar studies in that vein for a number of years. Now, solar energy is an intermittent, like wind energy, and so there are other challenges related to solar energy. But it appears that at the very least, you can have systems that are running on 30%, if you're looking at systems that do not include storage, wind and solar energy. And if the systems are widely distributed, it does appear that that number could be bumped up to as high as 80%, according to the National Renewable Energy Labs in the U.S. So that requires some pretty amazing management systems for moving energy around and very large structures for trading energy. It appears that the opportunity based on cost, based on energy return, and if you start to add in technical energy trading capabilities like the smart grid, it appears that there are a number of building advantages for new renewable energy sources like wind and solar versus base fossil fuels. And you can start to see this in places like island nations. For example, Kauai recently started to add solar plus storage, and the cost of their solar plus storage is half the cost per kilowatt hour of diesel-based generation, which they were using before. And in many regions, it's making sense to add solar, which is one of the reasons why this year solar added around 60 gigawatts of new power capacity. Solar added around 70, and wind added around 60. So those are pretty impressive numbers for renewable energy. And if you also look at cost, and cost is in some ways related to energy return on energy investment, it's not always directly related. There are other market factors involved. But there is some exchange between the two. And if you look at cost, solar energy has just been falling on a price basis very rapidly, to the point now that there are some new solar projects that are starting off at 2.4, 2.3 cents per kilowatt hour in regions where there's abundant sunlight, and the operators feel that they can really crank out a lot of solar-based energy supplies.
Now, tied to that, you also did a blog about the sites of resistance, despite the shadow of Trumpiness creeping across America and the world. Where is that resistance happening? Where can we win a little?
Well, I'll just give you one example. California has been working very hard to try and decarbonize the system. Now, don't get me wrong. There's certain things about California's energy policies, say, for example, some policies that promote natural gas-based energy sources, that being a pure, well, being someone who focuses on more purist responses to climate change, I'm not necessarily happy with. But California itself is moving leaps and bounds forward when it comes to decarbonizing its energy. They are promoting numerous efficiency measures. They are promoting solar rooftops. They are promoting wind energy. They are promoting electric vehicles. And in many ways, California, if the U.S. was like California, our rate of emissions reductions wouldn't be 1 to 2% a year. They would be more in the range of 5 to 6% per year or more. And California has a goal to have its electricity powered 50% by renewable energy by 2030. And that's very positive. The governor, Jerry Brown, recently stated that he would continue these policies regardless of who was in the White House. And in addition, has stated that he would launch satellites if GISS satellites were defunded. So that's one example of a bright spot in the U.S. And there are numerous cities and states that are following similar pathways. There are many businesses that promote a response to climate change and a reductions in carbon emissions. And these businesses, 640, wrote a petition to Trump asking him not to back out of the Paris Climate Summit. So there are these bright lights in the darkness.
Well, speaking of bright lights, what about all those lights in Las Vegas, Nevada? I mean, that used to be the case for climate. People going mad thinking about that. What have they done there?
Well, in Las Vegas, the city has decided to run its city operations on 100% renewable energy when it comes to electricity-based energy sources. And I think that's very positive. Las Vegas is going to have to work very hard to be sustainable. They're in a tough spot when it comes to regions that will tend to be impacted more by climate change. And I think that the city realizes this, and they're working to promote 100% renewable power for their city. And there are numerous cities around the country that are doing the same thing.
We called our last program, I Have a Confession to Make. It was based on something that you'd written. And, you know, at this point, I have kind of a confession to make. And that is that when I started broadcasting this show in 2006, my idea was to campaign hard to stop climate change. And I was idealistic. I thought that the communication of science of climate change was a key barrier. I mean, surely once people know, they will demand action and start making changes to their own lives. But now it's 2017. Some scientists are telling me, frankly, right on air, that it's too late. The world is committed to a lot of warming. We are likely well past the danger line for humans and our co-species. And sometimes I wonder, am I just here to chronicle the inevitable horror? Am I a horror writer now? Does it have to be that way?
So I think that if you look at life, Alex, it's both darker than we feared and more wonderful than we imagined. There is such a life surprises us. Our preconceptions are constantly destroyed, and so we need to be open to the potentials, not just the worst case, but the better case. So when you talk about inevitability, I would kind of step back from that. I would say what we're looking at is that we have some harms, some pretty very rough harms that are locked in. But my personal opinion is that life can find a way, that humans, if we choose to do the right thing, have the capacity to face down this crisis and survive. Now, I'm not saying that I think it's going to be easy, but we are looking at least probably 2C warming this century in the better case scenarios. Even if we get our act together completely, we're probably looking at 2C, and unless we can somehow pull an amazing amount of carbon out of the atmosphere over a very short period of time. So 2C is bad. We're at 1.2C now, and we're starting to see some things fall off the boat. But 2C is at least two or three times as bad when it comes to geophysical impacts. So even if we manage to do the best, we're going to face hardship. We're going to face trouble. And the only way we're really going to get through this is if we manage to pull together. I'm not saying that's going to happen. If it doesn't happen, then we'll probably have a civilization collapse at least, even in the best case scenario. But if it does happen, I think that in many ways we might end up stronger over the long term. We will learn how to take care of this place that we call home, this place that is so precious to us, that there is no green field of Mars that we can go off to and escape to. This is our home, and we're in a fight, whether we realize it or not, to save it from us. And if we fail, many of us, many of our children will not have prospects. Many people will probably perish. And not just because of climate, but because of the human system disruption that comes from it. But I don't know. I guess I can't give up. I can't just believe that we're just going to say, well, it's over. Our children aren't worth anything. All the things that we've done that are worthwhile aren't worth anything. All the people we love aren't worth anything. I can't believe that. I just can't believe that. Now, don't get me wrong. There are many people who are definitely in psychological denial. And there are many more people, I'm not saying like number-wise, but, you know, it's compared to number-wise. But there are a number of people out there that are trying to game the whole situation, that they think that they can come out ahead somehow. And in all honesty, you've got to just call bullshit on that. no one wins a zero-sum game when it comes to climate change. No one. You know, the wealthy are hated, or they learn to exploit people and brainwash them to the point where it's we have no soul anymore. So the issue with climate change is it's the lesson that we have had to learn over the centuries. And some societies have done it, and some haven't. And those societies that do not fail, and those societies that learn to work together and to take care of the people who have been victimized and the creatures that have been victimized and to take care of their environment, they survive. And that's what we are facing now. If we don't do it, we probably won't make it. But if we do, we've got a shot.
That's a huge and powerful vision, and I sort of hate to fall back to a tiny point, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the comments section in your blog, Robert Scribler's blog. And part of my theory is that when Joe Rome drew back from his famous Climate Progress blog, the educated commenters became homeless for a while, and then I think they got fired up by your blog. And, you know, incredible as it sounds, my web guy just told me that the Radio EcoShock website has a little script that so far has fended off 36,000 spam comments. And that's how, that's how intense the cyber war is out there. I figure every major oil, gas, coal, pipeline company either has an office full of social media hacks or they hire some other company to do their dirty work and to stuff every channel and stuff our brains with doubt and nonsense. How do you manage to keep your blog comments climate science friendly while keeping out those fossil fools and the hostile robots?
Yeah, that's actually Mortal Kombat online. I whenever I go into the blog section of my combat, I have to be armored up emotionally. The comment section of my blog, I said combat. But it's weird because the people that I love on the blog, the people that I support on the blog, I have to be open to them. I have to do everything I can to give them a forum where they can express their concerns or meet others or connect. And the opposite of that is keeping out the wolves. And there are some very, very real wolves out there. There are people that either individually they have an axe to grind with regards to climate change for whatever reason, or they're a part of some institutional structure that is out there trying to spread misinformation, and that could be a nation, that could be a corporation. And what I have to do is I have to look at the way communication is being expressed to try and determine whether or not it's genuine. In many cases, I can look at certain talking points and just immediately delete comments that include those. That's easy. There are more subtle comments that are either agitating or drop wedge issues into the forum that I tend to remove. And so what I have to do, though, is be active as a moderator continuously. And like you said, you get thousands of spam comments or what I consider to be malicious comments or comments from people that, are themselves, and the sad thing is that sometimes you just get people who are depressed and then they're just not going to make a positive contribution to the forum, and you have to decide whether or not to allow them to bring others into that spot with them or to try and continue to maintain a positive forum. And that is a huge challenge. And one of the reasons why I set up the Robert Scribler blog was to try and give people a safe place, to try and give people a chance to talk about climate change without having to constantly argue with climate change deniers about whether or not it warmed this year or whether or not global warming paused or just arguing over the latest point of disinformation, to actually be able to move forward and discuss the issue of climate change from the understanding that climate change is happening as the science has proved over and over again.
Tell us about one of your great contributors, a person that I followed. I got all kinds of links and sources from David T. Lang, and I was really sorry to see his stream of links stop and to hear that he passed away. Tell us about him and what he gave us.
So David began to contribute to the blog as a commenter back in 2014. And when he first came to the blog, he was very concerned about pollution, air pollution in particular. He had written his own blog on air pollution, and had, well, he had written numerous blogs, in fact. So one of them was he had to handle a wind spirit keeper. So, but David was also very concerned about climate change. He had covered the issue on his blog, and he came to the blog with a passion. And he would post probably about 10 to 20 comments at least a day and link to various media sources. And over time, it became, it seemed to me that this was something more than just someone who was passionate about it. He would describe the wildfires in the Pacific Northwest as a result of recent warming events called the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge. There was a very persistent ridge of high pressure that pumped temperatures up to well above average and produced extraordinary wildfires in British Columbia, in Washington, in Oregon, in California. And when these wildfires would roll through, David would talk about how he could feel it, how he could feel the particulate in the air getting into his lungs. It was acrid. And he was very sensitive to it. And I think this in many ways informed his passion. He also lived as a surfer. He loved nature. He was a very, very smart individual. He liked to share his thoughts with others. And in many ways, he helped me. He went over to local radio and would talk about articles that I had written. And there was one time when, there was an issue where there were sea creatures that had died that were washing up on the shores. And I was interviewed on that issue because of both a blog I had posted, but also David just talking to people, calling people up and talking to them. So for the 2 years that I knew him, it seemed like that this was a critical part of his life. And when he passed away, we found out that he had it was due to cardiac arrest and organ failure, but that there were probably complications due to the fact that he had trouble with his lungs for a number of years. And so when we talk about 7 million people perishing due to complications from air pollution every year, a lot of times that's just a statistic. But it's people we know. People we know that have heart attacks or strokes because their area might be more air polluted than another. People get emphysema or lung cancer as a result of the stuff that is belching out of these smokestacks. And to David, I think it was personal. He was trying to help others, but he was also, I think, trying to tell people something about himself.
Robert, we're starting to run out of time, and I could talk to you for hours, obviously, and I think it's partly because we are kindred spirits. I want to get in two quick points. The first is that I think what keeps both of us going is actually a sense of what well-being is and what good can be, and we have to know what good is to realize how badly things are going. Would you agree with that first point?
Absolutely. I don't know what else I can say to that. I think that if you don't know what good is, then you've got no light ahead of you. You've got nothing to move you forward. And so unless you've experienced something that is benevolent or have that life experience, then there's no real way to come up even with an ideal to move toward because you have no basis for it.
Well, the other necessary job qualification, I think, is the ability to keep having your mind broken. I mean, I see news or I'm reading science and it breaks me up again. How could this be? Can't everyone see what this means? And if I lose that, if I become jaded, then I will lose this show. I'll lose what makes Radio EcoShock. And I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that what you do, Alex, is very important. You listen and you share and you learn. At the basis, I think that that's kind of where we all are. If we close ourselves off, if we don't talk about what scares us or what we're passionate about or what we love, then we become separated from life. We become a part of a collapsing circle. But the opposite of that is also true. If you're reaching out to others, if you're allowing your mind to be broken and changed by others and by facts and by what's happening, then though it's painful, you are growing, you're living, you're taking part of life and you're contributing back to it. And I really appreciate what you've done here and I think that your voice is very important. So I hope you don't stop.
Well, I'm not going to. I mean, it just hasn't happened. I'm astounded almost daily. So I've just got to keep doing this. I can't quit, and I don't think you can either. Well, we do have to wrap it up. We've been listening to and just talking with Robert Marston Fanny. He's a science fiction author and the host of Robert Scribler's blog. You can find that at robertscribler.com. That's pretty easy, robertscribler.com. And I'll put a list of links to Robert's stories that we've talked about in the show and a couple that we didn't get to that I hope to. And I'll put that on my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much, Robert. And don't be a stranger. Let's talk a little bit more often. There's so much going on.
Well, I'm sorry. I get pulled in pretty hard, and I hyper-focus a lot. So I will definitely pop up more and more.
Radio EcoShock.
I want you to hear a short clip from a great podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, broadcast January 15, 2017. This clip features famous Penn State climate scientist, Dr. Michael Mann.
From the Commonwealth Club of California, this is Climate One, changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. Mike Mann, I'd like to ask you about a real legitimate villain, perhaps. Frederick Seitz was former president of the National Academy of Sciences, president of Rockefeller University, won many awards, and he, you write in your book, The Madhouse Effect, is a founding figure in the art of modern-day science denialism. So tell us how such a distinguished figure went to the dark side.
Yeah, I have some personal connections with Seitz in a sense. He was a solid earth physicist, a very distinguished, solid state physicist.
Flat earth.
So studying how materials work, and that's where I got my start in physics as well at UC Berkeley. I was studying in that area. And ultimately, he became president of the Rockefeller Institute, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He actually became president of the National Academy of Sciences. So when people say, how is it that, somebody that smart cannot get the science of climate change? It's not a matter of intelligence. I think we have to recognize that. There are ideological issues at work. And in his case, he actually ended up receiving, I think, something like $70 million from R.J. Reynolds Tobacco to found an institute whose primary function would be to attack the science linking tobacco and human health. And there's a famous saying attributed to Upton Sinclair. It's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on not understanding it. And so I think we have to recognize that there is denialism that comes from exactly the place that Renee is describing. There are various strains of denialism. Some of it comes from, a self-interested origin as well. And I think in some sense, that's the more challenging denialism to access and maybe convert and turn around, because it's so self-interested and it's so tied to ideology. I don't think any amount of information was going to convince the president, a former president of the National Academy of Sciences, that he was wrong about this science. I think he was absolutely convinced that he was right, and he was convinced that he was doing the right thing from a political standpoint. I think that's a harder nut to crack. I think it's part of what we face, the fact that climate change denialism, that people like the electrician that we're talking about, as I said before, I see him as a victim of a campaign, a massive disinformation campaign. The same interests, some of the same talking heads who were working for the tobacco industry decades ago, denying the connection between tobacco and climate change, are today receiving money from fossil fuel interests to undermine the public's understanding and policymakers' understanding of the science of climate change. And suffice it to say that those people, to some extent, were operating in the shadows. Given the latest round of nominations for various departments in our presidency, those people may now be controlling the reins of government, and that's something we haven't seen before.
I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to invite you to join the conversation on Twitter using our handle @ClimateOne. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and on podcasts and online. Thank you all for being part of this conversation today.
You can get that podcast, Is Climate Denial Destroying Our Planet?, from the Commonwealth Club of California for free on iTunes. We're out of time. I'm Alex. Please join me again next week on Radio EcoShock.